I'm going to talk about some recent work I did with my student, Casey Hsu. And of course, when I talk about work done with a student, what I mean is that the student did the work, and I was also there and told him what to do, at least to the vague extent of, you know, go work on this and report back. So, but this is based on an idea we had a while ago. And so I'm venturing into somewhat unfamiliar territory for me because I'm not really a quantum crypto kind of guy. But back when we were working on entanglement-assisted stabilizer codes for the first time, two of the reasons that we were interested in them were, first, that you could use them to design a broader class of quantum key distribution protocols. They're not really quantum key distribution protocols, they're quantum key expansion protocols, because in order to do them, they require the existence of a pre-shared key between the sender and the receiver. But you can base protocols like this on entanglement-assisted codes in the same way that you can base an ordinary quantum key distribution protocol on a CSS, a standard CSS stabilizer code. So that was one of the things we thought was interesting back in the day. And the other thing is, because in designing a standard quantum code based on classical binary codes using the CSS construction, you have to choose your codes to have this dual-containing property. That actually is a big restriction on low-density parity check codes. In particular, if you naively try to find two low-density parity check codes such that each code is contained in the such that each the dual of each code is contained in the other code. Then if you draw the Tanner graph of these codes, they have four cycles, which means the iterative decoders that are commonly used don't perform as well. And if you allow yourself to go beyond that restriction, which means you're constructing entanglement-assisted codes, you can use code families with higher girth for which the iterative decoder should work better. So this project is more or less combining those two ideas. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to review the quantum key expansion protocol and entanglement-assisted CSS codes very briefly. Then I'm going to talk about the class of LDPC codes that we use in this construction, which are finite geometry LDPC codes. These were first studied classically, like virtually everything. And then quantum versions of these were studied a few years ago by my former student, Min-Shu She, and his collaborators. Because when you construct the quantum versions of these codes, it turns out that they don't require a large amount of entanglement. So they have positive net rate, which I'll define in a little bit. Then I'm going to talk about how we have to modify the quantum key expansion protocol to take into account some of the practical issues that arise from using these codes. And I think it turns out in a very interesting way, the problems that you might think you would run into, you do run into, but it turns out they seem to all be soluble and leave you still with a good protocol. And then I'll talk a little bit about the particular results we found. That's the part that's hardest to do on the board, but I have a little graph I can show people if they want to see. I'm going to use the chalkboard, but I have my laptop here for moral support. Okay, so, and please, this, you know, I mean, this is should be very informal, so if anyone has any questions or wants me to say more or less about anything, you can let me know. Okay, so, the first part, so all the codes I'm going to talk about in this talk are CSS codes. So I'm going to talk about CSS codes And quantum key distribution slash quantum key expansion protocols. So we start with two classical binary codes. Which actually in the constructions that we use for our particular paper, we always took them to be the same. But that's something that could be explored. And these have parity check matrices. H1 and H2. Okay, so is everyone here completely familiar with QKD and CSS codes? So there's a head shake in the back anyway. All right, so the idea in constructing a CSS code is that a CSS code, we would construct X stabilizer generators from the rows of H1 and Z stabilizer generators from the rows of H2. So each row would have a string of zeros and ones, and we construct a Pauli operator with an identity everywhere there's a zero and an X or a Z everywhere there's a one. And then this set of operators generates the stabilizer of some code. And a nice thing about CSS codes, from a conceptual point of view, is you can more or less think of the quantum code that you get as the intersection of two classical codes. So the Z code detects bit flips, detects and corrects bit flips. And the X code detects and corrects phase flips. And so the intersection, if there is one, would be states that are code words of both codes and therefore can correct and detect both X and Z flips. Now, I'm not going to use this for error correction per se. This is just a stepping stone to designing a quantum key distribution protocol. But the handy thing about this is that I can describe the quantum properties of this kind of code using using binary matrices to represent the Pauli operators. Okay. So, if you just chose any two or any one, they don't have to be different from each other, binary code at random, and then naively constructed these operators, what you would find is that generically, this set of operators that you got here would not commute with the set of operators that you got here. And in order to construct a standard code, we actually have to choose these codes somewhat carefully so that, in fact, they all do commute with each other. And a way to check that is to look at the following quantity. If you multiply H1 times H2 transpose, then the elements of this matrix are the inner products between the rows of H1 and the rows of H2, binary inner products. And that means that if that inner product is zero, they have one in the same location an even number of times. And so the two operators represented by those two rows would commute with each other. On the other hand, if they intersected an odd number of times, those operators would anti-commute. So for a standard CSS code, we would require that this be the zero matrix. But it turns out that even if this is not the zero matrix, you can still construct a quantum code using these two parity check matrices, only now you require it to be an entanglement assisted code. So we call the rank of this matrix C, and it turns out that this C is the number of maximally entangled pairs that must be shared between Alice and Bob. So a protocol like this takes the following form. We have Alice up here and Bob down here. They initially share some number of maximally entangled pairs. Alice has some qubits that she wants to transmit to Bob. So she'll have some information qubits in a state psi and some number of ancillas in the state zero. And she puts these together with her halves of the entangled pairs into an encoder. The resulting states that come out go through some noisy channel on their way to Bob. And an important point is that Bob, the entanglement shared between Alice and Bob is assumed to be error-free at the beginning. So we've studied what happens if it's not, but for this talk, we definitely assume that it is. So this entanglement could have been prepared ahead of time by entanglement distillation, for example. So if these halves of the entangled pairs went through the channel at a previous time, we assume that distillation has been done to get rid of any errors. So then at the end, Bob measures the syndromes, and then he decodes an outcome psi, and then everything else can be discarded. So that's the picture for communication, quantum communication. But it turns out that this same code structure can be used to design the post-processing protocol for a quantum key distribution protocol. Okay. So, how is that going to work? So we have our two parity check matrices, H1 and H2, and this H1, H2 transpose has rank C. So C would be the number of maximally entangled pairs you would need in the usual error correction context. In the quantum key expansion context, C is going to be the quantity of initially shared perfect secret key that we assume Alice and Bob have before they get started. So they're going to use this secret key that they've already shared as a seed to construct a larger key. So the protocol they're using is the standard BB84 protocol. And so Alice, I'm sure everyone has seen it, but I'll go through it in just a moment. Now, in order to figure out how to do this post-processing, we need to modify the original description of these two codes. So what we'd like is we'd like to rearrange the rows of H1 and H2 so that they come into pairs representing anti-commuting operators that all commute with each other. So we can do that by a series of row operations. And those row operations can be represented by being multiplied on the left by some square matrix. So H1 and H2 get multiplied on the left by some matrix representing a set of row operations. And we choose T1 and T2 such that when we calculate this matrix, T1 TH1, H2 transpose, T2 transpose, it now takes a very simple form. Where certain of the rows have inner product one with each other and zero with every other row, and the remaining rows have inner product zero with all of the rows. So the size of this is a C by C identity. So the number of rows is n minus k1, and the number of columns is n minus k2. And we assume that the two codes, these are classical codes. So our two codes, H1 and H2, have the same size, n, of the code word, and the number of encoded bits is K1 for the first code and K2 for the second code. Okay.
Huh?
Yes.
So T1, T2 are invertible?
Yes, they're full rank binary matrices, square binary matrices, so they're invertible. That's very important. Yeah. Okay. Now, so just applying a row operation to a parity check matrix doesn't actually change the code at all, right? So long as it's invertible. Because the parity checks form a space, the span of the rows, and after any number of row operations, the span of the rows will still be the same. And so T1H1 and T2H2 are still describing the same classical code. Now, when we get to LDPC codes, of course, we may have lost the low density property that we were using there, so we need to worry about that, but we'll get to that in due course. Okay. So now we need to extend this code by including the extra C qubits on Bob's side in addition to the N qubits that are on Alice's side. And once we do that, then these codes will no longer have anti-commuting generators. They'll have commuting generators that work in the standard way. So having done these row operations, we then add an extra C columns onto the matrix.
What were we doing the row operations for in the first place?
We're doing the row operations to make this matrix take this standard form, right? So without T1 and T2, this matrix could be anything. All we know is that its rank is C. So now we have a matrix whose rank is C, but it takes this very simple form. And we can always do that. We can find row operations that do that.
So you shuffle it into a standard form for some purposes?
So for simplicity of analysis, basically. Once we have it in this form, okay. So if I'm doing error correction, my so in quantum error correction, I'd have stabilizer generators say G1 through Gn minus K, and in order to identify a quantum code, we require that these all commute so that they have a common plus one eigenstate or eigenspace. So if they don't all commute, by doing these row operations, what I've done is I've divided them into groups that have the following behaviors. I have GI, GJ, the commutator of that is 0 if I is one of the first N minus K minus C generators. So they commute with everything. Sorry. Then I have, sorry, let me do it like this. I have a set of, so I have N minus K generators like this. Sorry. So GI and GJ all commute with each other. But then I add an extra C generators. H1 through HC, such that GI, HJ, GI and HJ anti-commute if I equals J plus N minus K. So in other words, the last C of these generators have an anti-commuting partner amongst the extra generators that I'm adding. And the HJs commute with all the other Gs and with each other. So I now have a total of N minus K plus C stabilizer generator. N minus K minus C of them commute with each other and with all of the remaining ones as well. And then the remaining 2C of them come in pairs that anti-commute, but both members of the pairs commute with everything else. So these are what are called symplectic partners. So it's a property of the Pauli operators that any two Pauli operators either commute or anti-commute. So since these are all Pauli operators, necessarily it has to be one or the other. Okay? And what we did here, really, was we were reshuffling the rows around so that when we map them onto their corresponding operators, we get this relatively simple commutation relation. Okay? But because these anti-commute, there's obviously no common plus one eigenspace for this set of operators. So what we do is we go to a set of augmented operators. So for J equals 1 to C, we replace HJ with HJ tensor XJ, where now this XJ operator is on Bob's side. So in this picture, that would be Bob's half of the jth e-bit. And then the corresponding partner to HJ, which would be G N minus K plus J, goes to, right, so this should be plus C. Minus C. Okay. This goes to the same thing tensored with a Z on the same qubit. So now since these two anti-commute with each other, and the X and the Z on Bob's side anti-commute with each other, this operator now commutes with this operator. And they still commute with all of the other stabilizer generators. So this new set of generators forms a valid quantum code. But it's a rather peculiar code because C qubits of it are already on the other side. So that might seem like such a code would be useless for communication because you're assuming part of it is already on Bob's side. But this turns out not to be the case because if Alice and Bob share C EPR pairs initially, Alice can do the encoding into this code with the information qubits starting all on her side and just using her halves of the EPR pairs. So in fact, the qubits on Bob's side they can be pre-shared. They don't need to know anything about the information that Alice is transmitting.
So it's a bit like super dense coding.
In a sense, it is exactly super dense coding. The extra
in a sense, it is exactly.
It is. Well, okay.
Well, you hybridized it with CSS construction as well. So well, what's the inner sense?
The sense in which it is exactly super dense coding is that using an entanglement assisted code for the same value of n and k, you have C extra parity, extra parity check bits, C extra syndrome bits. And that means you have C extra bits of information about the error, at least potentially. So those C extra bits that you get are exactly the C extra bits you could get using super dense coding to send extra information about the error from the channel to Bob. Okay. So that's the sense in which it's exactly super dense coding. In another sense, it's inexactly super dense coding. Okay. So the binary matrices that correspond to these operators, we get by adding an extra C rows extra C columns onto the parity check matrix. So this is now N minus K1 by N plus C. So we've made it bigger. And we do the same thing with H2. So if we were going to construct a CSS code, then we'd use the rows of this matrix to construct our X stabilizer generators, and the rows of this matrix to construct our Z stabilizer generators, unless I said it the other way around the last time. Okay. So this binary matrix, then, each of the rows can be thought of as representing a Pauli operator. And we can now construct two other matrices. Then when we put the whole thing together, will give us two full rank matrices that are n plus c by n plus c. So if I call this augmented thing H1 prime and this H2 prime, then I'm going to construct two invertible n plus c by n plus c binary matrices like this. H1 prime, so that's the first n minus k1 rows. Then E1 and F1. So E1, these are represent the logical operators of the code. So in this case, if this represent, if these are the x stabilizer, these are the x logical operator. Yeah. So these have the last c bits are all zero. And we want these to commute with the stabilizers. So E1, H1 transpose, and E2, sorry, E1, H1 transpose, and E1, H2 prime transpose. These are all zero. And then F1 is an extra set of rows. Okay, so here we have N minus K1. This is, did I write down how big these things are? Let's see. This one is N minus K1 minus C. So this would be 2k1 plus c. I guess that makes sense. Okay. And these f1s correspond to canonical errors. That is, these are the errors that would flip exactly one of the stabilizer generators and leave the others unchanged. So these are not at all typical errors, but in some sense, it's not too important exactly how you choose these. The key point is that this is now an n plus c by n plus c full rank matrix. And I construct a very similar one on the other side. Only sort of upside down. Constructed in the same way.
What?
Yes.
I cannot see clearly. The E1 is the logical operators.
So the E1s, the rows here, if you map them onto Pauli operators, the same way you do with the with the rows of the parity check mapping on the stabilizer generators, those are logical operators of the code. So they all commute with both H1 prime and H2 prime.
So that condition for the matrix there, do you have one and one for the first two matrices and two and two for the second one? Like, I'm confused.
These are all two, yeah, they're all ones on this side and all
but
two.
But then why do we need the E1, H1t, comma, E1, H something, pi t equals zero?
Sorry, that's H2.
Okay.
So it commutes with both the, it obviously will commute with the, actually, I guess we only really need this one. It's E1, H2 prime t is equal to zero. So that the logical operators here commute with the stabilizer generators over here, and vice versa. Does that make sense? So in other words, the X logical operators commute with the Z stabilizer generators, and vice versa.
Okay, and you already have the conditions for the H1 prime and the H2 prime.
Yeah, so we've already made them commute. So, anyway, so we construct this one in a similar way. And the final, the thing that restricts how we choose F1 and F2 is that we're going to require that N1 times N2 transpose be the identity. So basically, every operator has a partner on the other side. Okay. So this is a lot of notation, so I apologize for that. But here's how this turns into a QKE protocol. Okay, so this is BB84. So Alice, so the beginning of is always the same, right? Alice sends Bob some number of qubits, so we'll say 2 plus 3 delta n qubits. Chosen randomly. From 0, 1 plus or minus. Okay. So we're all familiar with that. Bob measures in a randomly chosen basis. X or Z. A and B compare notes about the basis. And they discard any bits where the bases don't match. Okay. So Alice and Bob then randomly choose. Okay, and I should say that after this, they should have at least 1 plus delta n bits left over with high probability. If they have fewer than that, then they should discard and start over. So Alice and Bob randomly choose delta n bits to assess the channel. So they choose at random from their 1 plus delta times n bits, a subset of delta n, and compare them, and they count how many are different, and use that to derive an error rate, p. So that's what they're going to use in deciding what code to use for their post-processing. So we'll assume that I'm sort of doing things in a backwards order. Normally they would then decide what code to use based on the error rate, but here I'll assume that they knew all along what error rate they were going to get, and therefore n is exactly the right size for their code word. Alice's remaining n bits form a string, which I'll call A. So I'm going to treat it like a binary vector. And likewise, Bob has B. So, of course, the goal is first they want to eliminate any errors because they want their keys to match, and of course they want to eliminate any information that the eavesdropper may have acquired about the key. So they do that with a post-processing, with two post-processing steps. Well, I sort of everything is the same as quantum key distribution up to this point, but I'm now going to allow them to also have a pre-shared secret key. Size C. Okay, so Alice measures a syndrome which is H1 prime times the vector A, so that's her string of bits that she's left with after the BB84 sifting. And then she appends to that the pre-shared secret key K, which is assumed to be error-free and about which the eavesdropper knows nothing. And then she multiplies that by this augmented parity check matrix H1 prime. And that gives her a syndrome, SA. And she sends that to Bob. Okay? So Bob does the same thing, only he obviously uses his own string because he doesn't know Alice's, SB. Then Bob corrects the error syndrome. SA plus XB. So it's binary addition, bitwise XOR. Okay? On his string BK. So BK goes to BK plus some estimate of the error that he gets from the syndrome SA plus SB. Okay? And then the last step. I guess that's six. Alice and Bob decode. So for Alice, she takes her string AK, multiplies it by this matrix E1 that's been constructed, and that gives the new key KA. Bob does the same thing with his corrected string. And if the error correcting code they used was good enough to correct errors with the rate P, then these keys should be equal to each other with very high probability, and the eavesdropper should know nothing about the bits with very high probability.
It's the quantum error correcting code.
Right, if the quantum error correcting code corresponding to H1 prime and H2 prime is good.
It's not enough just for the possible error correcting code to be there.
Correct. So all right. So the only difference from standard QKD is that by including this extra key, we're letting ourselves use this larger class of codes. So we don't have to choose H1 and H2 to be orthogonal to each other. They can instead have some amount of non-commutativity between their rows, and then we compensate that by using some extra perfect key that they've already shared as a seed. So assuming that this correction is good enough, of course, they can then retain some of the new key that they've extracted to use as a seed for the next round of quantum cryptography. The rest of it can be used to send messages with, and so on. So obviously, you only want to do that if you're sure that this is, that you're doing a very good job, that your probability of error is sufficiently low. Okay, so that's QKE. So I spent an awful lot of time on that. Wow, I spent my entire time on that. Okay, so one down, three to go. I used 90% of my time already, so that leaves. Okay, well, let's say a little bit about these codes and then how we have to change things, right?
Or do you want just to jump to the results?
Well, I'll try to be fairly quick. The results can be stated quite briefly, I think. So, okay. So, just very briefly, we use finite geometry LDPC codes. The idea behind these, a finite geometry, you have a finite set of points and lines. Each point is intersected by some number of lines. Each line intersects some number of points. And two lines are either parallel or intersect at one point. Right. So the rules for lines and points are just the same as they are in normal geometry. Lines are either parallel or they intersect at one point. Normal Euclidean geometry, I should say. Only here, it's a discrete finite space, so the number of points is actually finite, and the number of lines is also finite. So you can enumerate all possible lines and all possible points. So these can be constructed in a variety of ways. I'll just say very briefly. So Euclidean geometry, because this one I think is easier to understand, each point is a P vector over the field GF 2 to the P, 2 to the S. So there are basically two parameters, P and S, that define this geometry. Lines are either 1D subspaces or cosets of 1D subspaces. So a line is just a line that's a 1D subspace is all multiples of some vector. And then we also include all the cosets, which are just the same thing offset by some constant vector. So you can work out for this that there are 2 to the PS points, including the origin, and there are 2 to the P minus 1 S times 2 to the PS minus 1 over P to the S minus 1 lines. That's obvious, right? But it's not at all difficult to calculate. Each point is intersected by 2 to the PS minus 1 over PS minus 1 lines. And each line contains 2 to the P minus 1 S points. So we construct H1, and we'll take H2 to be the same. Oh, sorry, Orbit. We have each column corresponds to one non-origin point. Each row corresponds to one line not through the origin. And then that element has a 1 if that point is intersected by that line, and 0 otherwise. So, because of the properties of finite geometry, this means that each column can have at most one non-zero element in common with any other column, because each column is a point, and they can only have a non-zero element in the same location if they're on the same line, right? And there's exactly one line between any two points. And similarly, each row can only share one non-zero element with any other row, because that's only possible if they intersect at the same point, and lines only intersect at a single point. So so this is a low density parity check, and you can write down these parity check matrices and calculate the amount of entanglement that you need. So since it's so late, I will not go through the details of that. But there's a large family of such code. And then there are several other related constructions. You can also use projective geometry instead of Euclidean geometry, where you sort of start with a Euclidean geometry in one more dimension, and then your points in the projective space correspond to lines in the higher dimensional space. And they have rather similar properties in many ways. So I'll just say a couple of things that you have to adapt in the algorithm to use codes of this type. So I really skimmed this, but are there any questions? Okay. All right. After we transform, our parity check matrices H1 and H2 to H1 prime and H2 prime they are no longer low density. So it would seem like the advantages that we wanted to use, namely the existence of very efficient decoders for low density parity check codes, are totally lost after we've done this transformation to put the codes in standard form. But in fact, this turns out to not really be a problem at all. So before using the iterative decoder, right, so we calculated this SA, which was H1 prime times AK. We then multiplied by the inverse of our row operation matrix to get a transformed version of this syndrome, and then use the decoder. The one we used is the sum product algorithm decoder. With the original, parity check matrix H1, which is low density. And because this T1 is an invertible operation, these two error syndromes contain the same information. And the thing is, the decoder for H1 prime would include the effects of this errors on the secret key, if there were any. But by assumption, this is always error-free. So in fact, as far as that's concerned, there's no difference between H1 prime and H1. Okay. The SBA decoder can fail to converge. So it's generally assumed in doing, when you write down a code, we just assume, okay, if I give you a syndrome, you can tell me what error that corresponds to. But of course, in practice, finding that error can be a very hard computational problem, which is the reason people like LDPC codes in the first place. However, even in LDPC codes, the iterative decoder will sometimes fail to converge. So it repeatedly iterates by adjusting the probabilities that it's assigning to the different possible errors, but it can get stuck in a closed loop or the equivalent of a local minimum and not converge in the length of time that we allow. So we only allowed it to iterate in our results for 100 cycles. And then if it hadn't converged at that point, we said it would that it had failed. Okay. So if this happens, we have to discard the block and start over. And in a somewhat related thing, where the decoder converges, but to the wrong error, the bits of the decoded block will be almost randomized. So if you run the decoder, but either you started with an uncorrectable error, or because it's a suboptimal decoder, it converged on the wrong result, what we found is that then the decoded key that we got actually was very noisy. And when the decoder succeeded, the key was essentially error-free. So in other words, when there's an uncorrected block error, all bit errors in the decoded key basically come from uncorrected block error. But this actually turns out to be a blessing in disguise, because since the keys are so bad if there's a block error, we can actually detect that there's a block error just by taking a sample of the final key and doing a last comparison. So we add an extra sampling and compare step. So this means that we can reduce the bit error rate almost as low as we want, at the cost of reduced rate. If we sample the bits and we discover there's an error, we have to discard that block. So we lose that rate, though obviously those are bits we should want to lose. But if it's working well, in most cases, there is no error, but we have to discard the bits that were compared because they have now been exposed to the eavesdropper. So there's a cost, it slightly reduces the rate of the whole thing. So that's the dominant effect. Yeah.
So, B also reduces the yield effectively.
Yes, that's right.
But you're using up key to do this protocol.
Exactly. So I knew you would see that, but that's my D. Are we wasting our key? Right. Because the whole point was that we had to assume that the net rate of key production was positive, but if every time we discard a bad block, we're throwing away some of our pre-shared key, that could turn the key rate negative. But it turns out that this problem is also solvable. So our solution is that we don't use the pre-shared key until the last step. So the first thing is, where do they use it? So Alice uses the key in calculating this error syndrome SA that she then sends to Bob. But in fact, Bob doesn't use SA as such. Bob uses SA plus SB. So this is Alice's measured syndrome and his measured syndrome. And SA plus SB is H1 prime times AK plus BK. But here you see that the Ks are just going to cancel out, right? Because the Ks are error-free, they contribute nothing to the to this difference between the syndromes. So we could just use A0 and B0 instead, and we get the same result. So Alice, instead of using AK to calculate the syndrome SA, uses A0. So she doesn't use the key until after they've run the iterative decoder to see if it converges. So if it fails to converge, then they can discard the block and they have not used any of the secret key yet. So then the last thing is if you get to this final stage, so the decoder converged, and then you look at a sample of the bits and you discover that that there was a block error. In order to calculate the bits of the key, again, you would use, right. You use the key to calculate the new key, right? And then they're using some bit, they're comparing some bits of KA and KB. But again, because K is error-free, they could use A0 and B0 in this expression to calculate a string that is not their final key, but is related to it. Compare the bits of that key. And if they detect no errors, so Alice and Bob compare bits of A0 times E1 and B0 times E1. And then they only add the extra vector corresponding to the pre-shared secret key if it passes the test. Okay. Now, obviously, after they've added that, they have to discard the bits corresponding to the ones they compared, because the eavesdropper has information about those bits. But assuming that the protocol works correctly in the ideal case, once they've discarded those bits, the eavesdropper should have no information about the remaining bits. So the interesting thing here, and one should do a really, really do a formal security analysis, but to check this last step in particular, but I believe it's correct, is that you can postpone the use of the pre-shared secret key until the very last step of the protocol, after you've done all of your checks up to that point, which means you never consume your pre-shared secret key unless you believe the result is going to be a good code block, a good key block. And only then do you consume it. So this means that if your initial protocol, your idealized protocol, has positive net rate, then the imperfect protocol with these extra fixes also will have positive net rate. You only use the key when you actually, you only use the pre-shared key when you're going to keep the final key. So I've already gone over time, so I'll call it quits. But if anyone wants to see the kind of performance, we were really interested in sort of the relatively high error rates, because that seemed like a practical regime. So sort of in the vicinity of a few percent error rate, say 2 to 8% is where these codes, we found codes that perform reasonably well. And what you saw, I'll just give you a sketch, is for any single code, you know, out to some point, the yield would fall off fairly sharply. But as you let the error rate go down, it would rise up, and then it would saturate like this. So this is, now you're down in the regime where this particular code can easily correct the errors most of the time. So you get, this is the code rate. And this is where it falls off due to bad blocks. So then, once you get to a lower error rate, at some point a different code is going to outperform this one. So you find from your family of codes, codes that perform well in different error regimes, and then you sort of, this outer envelope is more or less the achievable performance with this family of codes. And this is what we saw. So it more or less, all of the codes we looked at, once you hit about 8%, they were not really useful anymore. But when you got down to 7%, you had a yield that was non-negligible. And then at lower error rates than that, you could get pretty, you know, reasonably significant yields up to, you know, up to a half or so in this range, which is 2% to 7%. At lower error rates, it's really easy to find codes that do great. So that's, you know, that's not quite so interesting. But for instance, for free space communication, where you expect the error rates to be fairly high, this approach might actually be useful. The code blocks that we looked at had sizes on the order of about 10,000, so code words were about 10,000 bits long, which seems pretty reasonable for processing. We've seen some papers of people using different LDPC codes that have better performance than this, with blocks, but with much bigger block sizes, like a million. So that seems hard, but you know, we haven't explored all possibilities. So no guarantee that these codes are the best thing there are by any means, but they seem reasonable for the code size. They give reasonable performance. So we'll see what the referees think. All right, so sorry for going on, but thank you. If anyone has any more questions, I'm happy to answer.
Yeah, so I think people have looked at doing QKD using LDPC codes for correction before.
Yeah.
But I guess in that case, basically, using your terminology, only say the 8-1 would be an LDPC code.
Right, yeah. So the one I was referring to, I believe that's an example of that.
Okay.
I can't remember the authors, but I can look it up if you want. They were using big block sizes. They were sort of extrapolating the existence of LDPC codes sort of at every point in this range. But they were, yeah, I don't believe they were using them for decoding. But they didn't, I don't think they even really talked about that particularly in that paper. But I know other people have done it as well.
Yeah, so I guess my question is, what's the advantage you get by having both codes be LDPC codes?
Well, I suppose that since we only really use the H1 in the decoder, that there isn't any necessary advantage to doing it. We did it using the same H1 and H2 out of some, you know, seeming simplicity more than anything else. But I don't know that there's any advantage to it. One thing that we did do that I think is figuring out how you can defer the use of the pre-shared key to the end, which that could be used with other families of codes. And that again, doesn't depend on H2 being an LDPC code. So so that way, the nice thing about that was that what some of the other papers we've looked at, you know, they use some code and then they plot not yield versus error rate, but sort of the bit error rate of the key versus the error rate of the channel. But I think, in general, what you really want is a guarantee that your bit error rate is below some floor. You know, once you rise above that, you just wouldn't want to use that code. But what we can see here is we can actually push the code out further by doing these extra tricks to detect bad blocks. And actually guarantee that our bit error rate is still below the floor, which in our case we took to be 10 to the minus 6, but it could be, you know, there's nothing magic about that number. Okay. Yeah?
So this technique that you don't use the key until the decoding is known to be successful, Is there an analog in the time assisted code as well?
Is there a what?
An analog of the technique in the time assisted code itself.
So you don't use the entanglement until the end? Or something
I'm
like
wondering,
that?
Like, is it possible to say Alice is such an encoding with a local maximum entangled state? And only if, well, that assumes that she can hear back communication from Broadwell. That, like, I was thinking whether she can do some kind of entanglement swapping to get to only use her entanglement, knowing that the decoding is successful. But it does seem to require back communication, and that really changed the game.
So that's a good question, and I don't know the answer. But I do. I will tell you a speculation that I've thought about in the past, which is, so there are certain kinds of classical codes, which are variable length codes, where you use feedback from the receiver, right? So you're encoding your bits, and you send them through the channel, and the receiver, on receiving them, is trying to decode your message. And they, from their checks, can tell whether they're successfully decoding or not. And then they send feedback to you so that if they're not decoding, you can send more bits to supplement the ones they've already received until they're finally able to successfully decode. So I've talked to some guys who work on this kind of thing. I forget the context. It's maybe when the channel is very variable and they're not sure when it's going to be good and when it's going to be bad. But it occurred to me that you could do something sort of similar to that quantum mechanically, in the sense that in a quantum code, the information is kind of delocalized. It's not obvious whether until you do your final decoding step, it's not necessarily localized on Alice's side or Bob's side. If you imagine her sending her qubits one at a time, then you could probably set it up in some ways that if she sends some qubits and they get disrupted, she could still completely recover her state on her own side. And if she sends enough, then eventually Bob can completely recover it on his side and she has no information about it. So I don't know if you could, you could, for instance, design a protocol where Alice holds off using her halves of the shared e-bits until she hears some feedback from Bob about what he's seen, measuring some of the earlier stabilizer generator. So this was a very vague idea that I had a number of years ago. I haven't worked on it at all to see if that actually can be a sensible protocol. But
here's a kind of dumb way of doing that,
right?
Alice doesn't even try to send anything for a while. Instead, she just concentrates on preparing extra EPR pairs with Bob.
Right.
And they do entanglement distillation.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they have lots of extra EPR pairs,
mm-hmm.
then they do something.
Yeah. So that could, right. So that would sort of have that same, that general
the strange thing
structure.
Is that the possibility to delay using entanglement.
Yeah.
You tell us something about QB, the back assisted quantum capacity, rather than the two-way one.
Yeah, but actually now that I think about it, this is the back assisted capacity, right? Because you can use one-way entanglement distillation to create these EPR pairs.
Yeah.
And then Bob is only telling, wait, so
no, but
the back, what's the back assisted capacity?
You only have three back cars of communication.
Yeah, I think you would only need back communication.
Actually, trying to do a number swapping require a fair bit of back communication and a fair bit of forward communication.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
Well, I think in this case though, if a protocol like I was just describing existed, it could be done using only back communication, right? In the QKE protocol, it requires communication from Alice to Bob to tell him the syndrome, but in here, he has the bit, so he's the one who measures the syndrome himself. So he just needs to communicate to Alice saying, these are my results so far, you need to send me, you know, more
but
qubits.
But if the swan is small, only after they know that it's successful, then the swapping itself require forward communication to make corrections.
Yeah.
So it's significant amount of forward communication and a little bit of back communication. So that's similar to the way this key expansion protocol is like, it's intrinsically two-way.
It's true that the part where you decide to discard the block, yeah, it's one way except for that, right? You need two-way for that. I think everything else, no, you need two-way, right? It's intrinsically two-way, right? Because you need to compare the bases. Yeah, so it is two-way, you're right.
QKD usually is just bad communication is sufficient. Because Bob can make all decisions about what the things to measure are and things like that and send that to Alice.
He needs to know what basis.
So he needs to know, right, sorry, you need to know whether you succeed or not.
Yeah. So, I think that, for this you need...
Yeah, for the bases, right.
Right. So for this, the part where you're checking the blocks, I think... I mean, Bob does most of that, but they do have to compare bits, right? Anyway, yeah, so I'm not sure. But anyway, I have speculated, but not really tried to work out, you know, whether there's a sensible version of a variable length quantum code where you can use varying amounts of entanglement depending on the results of Bob's first however many syndrome measurements.
But the point is that the comparison will have to be made against the two-way protocols instead. Right? I mean,
yeah,
the initial hope is that, oh, maybe that's a really nice way to use a tempo-assisted code with less entanglement.
But wait, why do you need two-way in this? I mean, you obviously need quantum communication from Alice to Bob, but it seems like all the classical communication goes from Bob to Alice. Why is it two-way?
Well, at least in the dumb protocol that I described.
Oh, for
Alice,
the distillation.
Yeah, Alice still needs to then teleport.
Also, in my dumb protocol, we have the swapping. You need forward communication to fix up the swapping itself.
Right, okay. So, but what I was saying, right, so the version you were using where you're using teleportation requires classical communication this way. But an entanglement-assisted code is generally not equivalent to teleportation. I mean, there are ones that are, but
in
mostly
general,
they're not.
Back-assisted protocols usually can outperform the assisted case by a lot.
Okay.
Right, think about the 50-50 erasure channel.
Right.
So,
that's
and it's totally not understood. So that...
Yeah. Well, so yeah, I mean, I haven't worked on it, but I think, you know, I don't see why such protocols are not possible. Then you could use different amounts of entanglement depending on the feedback from Bob. Because the order where you... Yeah, I mean, you can more or less think she does the encoding. I mean, here's one way. She does the encoding with a lot of entanglement, but she holds back some of those bits until, you know, she heard back from Bob. So she sends some bits, but she retains the rest until she's heard from Bob, where he has enough information to reconstruct the state on his side, at which point they should be able to recover entanglement from the bits that she has. The remaining bits that she has. So I think that's the way I was thinking it would work. Right? It's sort of, if you think about a code word, right, you can think of the logical operators as being localized in different places depending on which stabilizer generators they're multiplied by. So if Bob measures a particular set of stabilizer generators that's sufficient for him to localize the information on his side, then the remaining ones just contain entanglement with Alice and no further information. I think that's the way it would work, but I haven't tried to work out an actual example. So it's just something I thought about a few years ago. Okay. Well, thanks.